Hi, everyone. Before we started the show, I wanted to kind of warn people about this episode. Might be triggering for some people. You can tell from the title it has something to do with illness. However, I primarily talked to my guest about her daughter having cancer. Now, this story has a happy outcome. However, I understand that this is a sensitive subject for a lot of people, so I just wanted to give a quick warning. All right. Thanks, everyone. Hi, I'm Laura LaBelle, the host of The Impossible Job, a podcast about the misadventures in parenting that every parent goes through, regardless of who your family is. Not an expert, just a parent. The Impossible Job podcast is supported by RichmondToDCHelpWanted.com, the hometown advantage. Most folks who work here love living here. They care about the community. At RichmondToDCHelpWanted.com, they're proud to work with the hometown advantage around the clock, connecting local employers to local job seekers. RichmondToDCHelpWanted.com makes it easy to post a job, and it's local, so you won't get spammed by faraway job seekers. Post your job today on RichmondToDCHelpWanted.com. And if you're looking for a good local job, search jobs and apply online right now. Get the advantage of finding a job close to home at RichmondToDCHelpWanted.com. Local jobs that work. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Impossible Job. On today's show, my guest is Dana. Dana is a full-time working mom of a little girl named Olivienne. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Of course. Why don't you just tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Okay. My name is Dana, like you said, and I've been married to David for 5 years. We just celebrated 5 years being married a few weeks ago.
Congratulations.
And we've been together for 12 years.
That's awesome. Good.
Thank you. And I work in an engineering firm doing marketing, and David is a firefighter, paramedic, and also has his own landscaping tree business.
Oh, awesome.
And then we also have Livy, who is going to be 2 in June.
2. Awesome. Is she getting into everything?
Yes.
Yeah.
She's getting so big and just talking a lot now, and it's really cool to see her just learning and growing.
That's awesome. Yeah, our Willie, he's 2, and he is just... He's super curious, but he gets into everything and drives me a little nuts, but but they're fun. They're fun.
Yes.
Well, today we're actually going to be talking about how to deal with illnesses. Sometimes, they're little illnesses, and sometimes they can be kind of really big. And you actually have some personal experience with this. Livy was diagnosed with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
How old was
she? She was diagnosed at 4 months old. We found out that she was diagnosed with neuroblastoma.
Okay. What can you tell us what exactly neuroblastoma is or what it affects?
Sure. So neuroblastoma is a type of solid tumor, and it usually forms near the spine or kidneys and in the abdomen. It can be, very slow growing, or it could be very fast and rapid and aggressive. But it's usually the average age of diagnosis is 2. Mm. It can be younger or older. And there's just so many wide ranges of diagnoses within neuroblastoma. It's a little less common than leukemia and other childhood cancers. There is only about 700 cases diagnosed a year.
Oh, wow. When you found out, I'm sure that was... I can't even imagine how you would felt. I mean, my son, Willie, somewhat recently, he had cellulitis in the area around his eyes, and he was hospitalized for all of a day. But the entire time we were there, I felt nauseous, like I felt like I was going mm-hmm. to literally throw up with any like sort of news that they kind of gave us. So I can't imagine what you were going through at that time. Can you tell us a little bit about like the first signs that you had or that you kind of gave you warning about it or what alerted you to it?
Sure. So the first signs that we saw was that she was sweating a lot, and it wasn't that she was just like, oh, a sweaty kid. Mm-hmm. Whenever I would nurse her and this just happened out of the blue one weekend, she just started sweating profusely. Mm-hmm. When I would nurse her or when she was sleeping, just in a matter of seconds, she would be drenched in sweat, like dripping from her head all over, just in a pool of sweat. So I knew that this can't be normal. This can't just be just normal, hot, sweaty kid. I mean, she was born in June, but still. So I took her to the pediatrician, and he was kind of stumped. He didn't really know what was causing the sweating. He got to see it firsthand, though, because she fell asleep in the doctor's office. And he couldn't believe how much she was sweating. So he listened to her heart, and he said her heart sounded really great. He was thinking it was maybe her heart because, you know, working so hard nursing or being active like that, he thought maybe there was some defect or something. But he said she sounded good, and I said, you know, could there be anything that you can't hear? And then that's when he had us go do blood work, and he just was so confused as well.
Mm-hmm. Did they find out, I mean, once you did get your diagnosis, I mean, do you know what was the cause of the profuse sweating? Like, what caused it besides the...
So, I guess what they said was her tumor was secreting a lot of hormones.
Okay.
And when they did more invasive blood work, it showed that her norepinephrine levels were, like, sky high, like tens of thousands of higher. And it's so weird because... that's not like a typical symptom of neuroblastoma.
Okay.
And so it was kind of weird that she was sweating, but I'm so thankful that she was, because otherwise we would have never known. She didn't have a distended belly or anything. Mm-hmm. That's usually the typical sign when they're diagnosed as babies. There's, you know, a big tumor in their abdomen and their stomach swells up, or they can feel it. Like, her pediatrician couldn't even feel it because it was sort of tucked up into her ribs and her chest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so even it was the first scan that we saw, it was a baseball size in a little four-month-old, and they couldn't even feel it just by palpating her stomach. So it was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, so you got the blood work and then you got the scan, and the scan is what showed the tumor.
Right. So her blood work, after we saw the pediatrician, we went and did blood work, and he called us that night, and he said her blood work looked great. Like, there was no issues with it. The only thing was that her electrolytes were low, obviously, because she was sweating.
Mm-hmm.
So he was still kind of stumped and told us, go to the hospital tonight and get admitted and get fluids, and then tomorrow do some tests. And so we were kind of freaking out by then. And then the next day they did a heart ultrasound where they saw the mass, but they didn't tell us yet. So they wanted to do more. And they did an ultrasound of her abdomen and still didn't tell us anything. And then they finally did a CT scan, and that's where they could see kind of the extent of the size and where it was exactly. And that's when an oncologist came in and told us he thought it was neuroblastoma, but they wouldn't know for sure until she had a biopsy done. And, you know, when we saw it on the screen, we couldn't believe it. Because she was just acting so normal, and she was a healthy, you know, gaining weight, healthy baby.
Yeah.
And we just could not believe that that was growing inside of her. I mean, it was huge.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, all I can think is, like, my heart would probably just sink into my butt, honestly. That's just...
yeah, it was, I mean, it's like an out-of-body experience to be told, you know, that your baby has cancer. So I just... I was in denial for a while. Like, you can't even wrap your brain around it.
Yeah, no, I think that's normal. I think that would be normal for anybody. From what steps did you take forward after that?
The doctors in the hospital that we first went to, after we were inpatient for a while they were trying to get her sweating under control and plan for her biopsy, they were thinking it was also possibly this other type of benign tumor. So they had to put her on some medicine first because I guess if they cut into it, it could be very deadly or something if they didn't block the hormones. So that was scary too, like thinking that could happen. And so they put her on all this medication. We had to wait at the hospital for a week or two. And then she had her biopsy a few weeks after we found it. And then after that, she had to do a few other tests to see if it had metastasized anywhere else, like a different type of scan, a nuclear scan, different than a PET scan. This MIBG scan specific to neuroblastoma. And all of that was just taking so long. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't officially diagnosed with neuroblastoma until December, and we found out about the tumor in November. So by that point, we decided, I think we need to see a second opinion, because it just felt like to us, the doctors that were caring for her at our first hospital may not have had as much experience with this since, mm-hmm. you know, like I said, there's only 700 cases diagnosed a year. So,
right. And they usually, and it seems it's not as common for it to be in younger kids.
Right.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
Younger,
so they don't really
I mean,
see it that much.
Right. You know, like a 4-month-old versus like a 2-year-old.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
So after that, then we went to Cincinnati, and the specialist that we saw there, he finally staged Livy, stage 3 intermediate risk.
How many?
And in that 2 months, her tumor actually ended up growing. So that was also pretty disappointing and scary.
Okay. How many stages are there?
So there are 4 different stages, and there are 3 different risk categories. So there's stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the different risk categories are low, intermediate, and high risk. And there's so many different markers and different factors that determine the stage and risk category, like age is a factor. The younger you are, the better the prognosis. So it was, you know, kind of a relief that we did find it so early.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always the case. There are some babies who are younger who do have, you know, a higher risk,
mm-hmm.
but it's on average, the lower the age, the lower the risk, so that's good. You know, it depends on if it's metastasized. It depends on different DNA markers of the tumor. There's just so many things that go into the staging.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Yeah, that sounds very
complex. That can be really confusing.
Yeah. So with all this, like, travel and then the bad news and then the long waiting for the answers and stuff like that, like, how did you cope with all of that?
It was really hard to cope with all of that. You know, I tried to go online and research as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
I found, actually, my college roommate, she had a friend whose high school friend had a son who had neuroblastoma. So she connected us. And that was kind of the first person that I connected with, and, you know, didn't feel so alone. And so she then told me about this support group on Facebook, and it just opened up a whole world of knowledge and support that way.
That's awesome. I'm so glad that you were able to, you know, outside of, you know, family and everything like that, you actually find mm-hmm. someone that was kind of going through or had gone through the same thing you did, so you could maybe see the light, hopefully, at the end of the tunnel there.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important. Were there any, like, other obstacles that kind of went in through the whole treatment and anything like that?
So I think, you know, some of our biggest obstacles were first getting staged and figuring out the treatment plan. I mean, it took us 2 months to finally, you know, figure out a plan of what was going on. So when we came back from Cincinnati, we ended up switching hospitals. Mm-hmm. And with that, like switching hospitals in Tampa, and with that, you know, just the difficult decisions that we had to make were huge obstacles. The specialist in Cincinnati suggested that she do 8 rounds of chemo, and the doctor here at home suggested 4 rounds. I didn't even know what to do at that point. So I needed some more backup and data from the doctor here on why he only wanted to do 4 rounds, and kind of felt at peace with that. Other obstacles were, you know, having a baby with a central line. So that's basically an IV that goes straight into her chest to her heart, and that's where the chemo went, and she would get blood draws from it. And she had to, you know, we had to make sure that it was sterile at all times, and with a baby, like, pulling at things and everything.
Yeah.
That was really difficult, and having to get blood draws twice a week from that, and doing dressing changes once a week, and giving her shots, and just all of that stuff, like, not knowing if she was in pain. Or how she was feeling, only just going by how she was acting. Mm-hmm. And with that central line, we had to kind of keep her away from family and friends, because if she got even the slightest little fever, we had to take her to the hospital to get blood cultures to make sure it wasn't an infection, and it could also delay chemo. So that was really hard, all of that.
Oh, my God. I mean, honestly, that sounds, I mean, that's a living nightmare, but it sounds like you and David were just rock stars.
I mean, thankfully, David, with his paramedic background, it was just amazing, the stuff that he knew and could do, and just having that, I think, was really helpful.
That extra knowledge was probably a blessing. Mm-hmm. Were there, like, any operations that she ultimately had to go through, or did the tumor just shrink with the chemo?
So she had 4 rounds of inpatient chemo that we started when she was 7 months. And after that, it had only shrank about 50%. So they decided to do surgery, and that was another big decision we needed to make, because since there aren't very many cases of these, the surgeons here at home hadn't done very many. Mm-hmm. And hers was kind of, her tumor was sort of complex, where it was wrapped around her descending aorta and around some arteries, so it's very risky. Mm-hmm. And even the specialists in Cincinnati, the surgeon there said that they would only take out, 75% of it. So we ultimately decided to go to New York to Memorial Sloan Kettering. And there is just an amazing surgeon there who's just world renowned. And we made a decision to go there for surgery. And he was able to take out everything that he could see, is what he always says.
Wow. So how is Livy doing today?
She's doing great. She is a healthy, happy, and active toddler, and she's currently cancer-free. So she gets monitored every 3 months with an MRI and urine test, and her last few scans have said no evidence of recurrent or residual disease. So that's amazing. And we celebrate every 3 months when we see that report.
Yeah, I bet.
And she gets, monitored also with hearing tests and a heart echo to monitor any effects of the chemo. But overall, she's doing amazing. And if you see her, you wouldn't even know that she went through all of this. She, like, kids are just so resilient, and and bounce back, and she's doing great.
That's amazing. So when you go to get these MRIs, does she kind of know now, or is she kind of like used to it, or is it still kind of...
I don't know. I've wondered that as well, like as she gets older. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, she can't eat for, 6 hours before, and we usually try to do them first thing in the morning so that she's not really affected by that. Mm-hmm. So... she does pretty good. It's about an hour drive to the hospital. And she does pretty good. And then we wait for a while, so that gets kind of antsy, but I don't know if she's kind of remembered it yet, but she does pretty good with them. She gets sedated for the scan. So it's sort of like a all day thing where we have to wait, and then she gets sedated, and then the MRI, and then we have to wait for her to come out of the sedation, and then she's just like ravenous and hungry when she wakes up, and sort of loopy, and then she just plays after that. So I don't know if she really knows yet, but I'm sure as she continues to get a little older, she might.
Yeah. How much longer will she have to kind of go back for the MRIs?
So typically, they're monitored every 3 months for the first year. The oncologist in New York suggested, due to certain markers that she did have in her tumor that aren't, you know, very good markers, mm-hmm. He suggested that she get monitored every 3 months for the first 2 years. So we'll have to talk to her doctor here about that. And then after that, they usually space them out to 6 months, and then 9 months, and then 1 year. And then usually out 5 years from end of treatment.
Okay. Oh, man. So what are, like, I mean, obviously when you kind of got the news and mm-hmm. through all the ups and downs through, like, the treatments and operations and things like that, you had to go through some sort of, like, grief process, right? Like,
yes.
How did that, like, what kind of toll did that take on your relationships with your family and friends? And, I mean, I assume also that you'd be out of work a lot.
Yes. So definitely went through a grief process, and sometimes I still struggle. After Livy was healthy and I went back to work, I started seeing a therapist, and she's helped me a lot. And I kind of learned about the grief process and kind of knowing what I went through. Definitely went through denial.
Right.
And it seemed like I would wake up and be in a bad dream, or my mind still, like, was on maternity leave, and then I would realize, oh, wait, this is real life. Yeah. And then it was hard because, like, I didn't want to talk about anything, and I just tried to hold everything in, because if I talked about it, then it meant that it was real. And so obviously that wasn't really good, and kind of led to some anxiety and depression. And I had a lot of anxiety about just, like, social situations. It was really hard to see friends and, like, even go to the grocery store, and just germs and everything was kind of amplified. Like,
yeah, just became hyper aware of everything. And that's exhausting.
And it was kind of hard. Like, it did take some tolls on some relationships, like friends and family. They, you know, some people didn't know what to say, and, you know, rightfully so. It's such a huge thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I probably wouldn't know what to say to someone either. So that kind of, you know, put some distance between some, like, family and friends. And with work, I had just taken my maternity leave for 3 months. I had just gotten back to work for, like, about a month. Mm-hmm. And so that was really hard. I didn't have any more PTO, and I was, you know, they said I could go on FMLA. Livy was under my insurance, so I was really stressed about that. I couldn't even tell them when I would be back because I had no idea.
Right.
So that was really hard. Luckily, they allowed me to, like, say, you know, do whatever I needed to do, and kept Livy on my insurance and everything, and just, you know, I updated them along the way, and then I was able to go back to work. So that was amazing.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, what were things that people did say or did that did actually help that helped you or supported you? Like, what were some of the best things that people did or said to you?
So, you know, just bringing us food and bringing us things to the hospital meant so much. You know, eating hospital food all morning, noon, and night, it just gets old, and having meals. And when we were home, like, you know, you don't want to cook. You don't want to think about any of that stuff. So meals were really great. Care packages and, you know, like, you sent us a care package that was filled with just anything that we could use, like, so much good stuff, and it meant so much to us. And just, you know, having people tell you that they're thinking of you, and even if they don't know what to say, like, that meant a lot to us. Also, just people telling us about, like, success stories or giving us hope and, you know, connections to resources and support and that kind of thing was also very helpful. It wasn't very helpful if people were just telling us about, you know, oh, my sister's brother's uncle, like, had cancer too, and I was so sad. And it doesn't really relate to someone who's in a different situation and right. Doesn't really help. So all those things really helped. Just reaching out and saying, not necessarily, is there anything that I can do? Because that is also hard, because you can, when you're in it, you really can't think of things. Yeah. So when people just take
too
the initiative
open-ended.
And just did things for us, like, that was super helpful.
Yeah. Okay. So if someone were in the same situation, don't be like, hey, can I do anything for you? Just do it.
Just do it.
Just
and
do
just
it.
Be like, hey, what kind of, you know, sandwich do you want? Or, like, you know, something like that. Or,
yeah.
Or what, you know, I'm bringing you dinner. Do you have any food allergies? Or, you know, just do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there any, so you said you found, like, resources online to help mm-hmm. educate yourself, and you also found, like, this support group. Were there any, like, I mean, like, what else were those, like, resources? Like, did you find, like, really good books or other, like, articles, things like that? Or
no, I mean, I, like, when I searched the internet, I was looking at certain studies and things like that, just research that was out there. The Facebook support group was, like, my main thing of education, because it was, you know, the direct source of parents going through the same thing. Going through it, I, you know, ended up making some strong bonds with other moms that, you know, I talk to almost every day. A lot of foundations out there as well, which it was hard to find them at first, but our nurses at the hospital told us about a couple, and just, like, good foundations that, you know, bring joy to the families when they're going through cancer or an illness and things like that.
Okay. So, yeah, so, like, medical staff, they were a pretty good resource for you.
Yeah, the nurses. The doctors were a little bit more just informational, and you kind of have to ask more questions and keep asking questions. So.
Right. Okay.
Sometimes it was a little confusing because they would use, you know, big words that you had no idea what they were talking about. But we had some really great nurses, too.
That's good. What kind of advice would you give to a parent that might be going through this?
Ask and accept help. I mean, that is really hard to do when you're in that situation because, you know, nobody really wants to ask for help. That's tough to do. So just accept it. Just let people help you. Don't be afraid to seek second opinions and advocate for your child. There was a lot of times during our journey where, you know, there were red flags and we questioned things, and, you know, we seek the second opinion and even a third opinion mm-hmm. in New York. And I firmly believe that, you know, the surgeon that we saw in New York, like, that's the reason she's cancer-free right now. So just trust your instincts and your, you know, your mama intuition mm-hmm. because it's there for a reason. And also don't dwell on what you could have or should have done and kind of, you know, because I always would think about, well, what if I got, you know, what if I pushed for a sonogram at the end of my pregnancy? Would they would have found something or not? Or, you know, you can't really dwell on things that already happened. So just kind of focus on what you can do now and for the future, and like just focus all that energy on like getting your child the best possible care now.
No, that's really good.
And then also for yourself, I mean, seeking support and therapy was probably the best thing I did. I had so much anxiety when I was going back to work and kind of entering back into the real world and not being home cooped up or going to clinic or hospital. It's hard to kind of that transition.
Well, yeah, and because for so long that was your life. That's what you did.
Right.
That was your routine. And I think when anybody breaks their routine, no matter what it is, it's going to be hard. And then if you're left with this like residual anxiety about like, what if I'm not there and I miss something or like a sign or something like that, that can definitely be insanely stressful. So,
yeah. And I wanted to, I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I mean, I still have a little bit of anxiety sometimes, of course, but it doesn't take over like it used to or prevent me from, you know, doing things or talking to people or, you know, going to social situations like it did before. And I wanted a specialized therapist that was, and so I found somebody who was specialized in family therapy and had experience with trauma and grief. So I think that's important too, to find somebody who, you know, you can relate to what you're talking about and feeling. So that's been super helpful. And talking about it, like, don't hold it all in. That's a big thing that I would say too. And it's not going to last forever. That's what I've learned in therapy. It's not going to last forever. And you're strong and you'll get through it. And yeah.
How did David cope with everything?
He is a different breed. Mm-hmm. I think he was very opposite of me, which is probably good. He's very medical and very
pragmatic.
He just, yes, like he looks at things like, okay, well, this is what it is, and this is what we're going to do, and we're going to do it, and it'll be okay. And, you know, that kind of thing. So, like, sometimes when I'm, you know, breaking down, being scared of, you know, relapse, or, you know, I'm scared of things like that happening to her, or I, you know, he's just like, well, we have our, you know, our good doctors, and well, you know, you deal with things when they come. You don't, you know, don't try to
fix something that hasn't happened
things.
Yet.
yeah. So he's really good, and I think him coping that way, you know, actually, I think it opened him up some more too. Like, now he sort of talks about things more, and you know, because of all of this. So that's good too. And, you know, the whole thing was so difficult to go through, and sometimes it can like make or break relationships. Mm-hmm. But I think it made our family a lot stronger because, you know, we were together so much. He was out of work as well. And we both stayed with Livvy in the hospital when she was there, in and out of the hospital, and, staying in a small, tiny, confined room and taking care of a baby that's going through all that. It was really stressful, but also kind of strengthened our relationship, I think.
Yeah, I think that's amazing, because I do think of that with when Avery and I kind of going through life stuff, but it might be difficult life stuff. I do stop and think, like, you know, this is really hard, but I wouldn't want to do it with anybody else.
Exactly.
So I know I'm very lucky to, you know, have a partner, but I think that's, I think that's really amazing that you and David also have that partnership where you're both kind of can lean on each other. So that's really good. Is there any advice that you would give to maybe somebody that knows of somebody that's going through this?
Sure. I mean, I guess have them, you know, just support them as much as you can, even if that's just checking in with them, researching stuff for them, that could be helpful. Also, just the other night, I found a, you know, GoFundMe page on Facebook that, you know, some Facebook friends were sharing, and it was another baby in my town that was diagnosed. I don't know if it's neuroblastoma or not, but, you know, like, I reached out to friends of a friend that knew them, and I, you know, just having someone to connect with, mm-hmm. I think, is so helpful, because they already have the knowledge of everything, or just know that what you're going through, like, going through an illness is, it can feel so lonely, like, you know, your family and friends want to be there to support you, but it, you still just feel like they don't know what you're going through, and it's hard. And I guess also don't always tell them that, just kind of listen to them, and I think give them hope, but don't say, like, for instance, when people say to me, oh, Livvy's good now, like, she'll be fine, you know, they don't know that.
Don't minimize the anxiety that maybe the parent is going through. Just
right. Don't minimize that, because it's real, and saying it's going to be fine when they don't know, it doesn't help.
Yeah.
So tell, you know, just listening to them is helpful. And another thing is, you know, give them comfort and support, even if it's just like giving them a hug. I saw this really good diagram that explains, like, a good comfort and support. If you know somebody who's going through a trauma, support them and the person that's closest to the trauma. But if you want to vent and grieve, like, that's okay too, but do it to someone who's further away from the trauma.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, because so, you don't want to,
yeah. So like,
want to push positivity in and just
in. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then grieve and vent out. Like, mm-hmm. even though you're not going through it, like, you can still be grieving and mm-hmm. upset, but don't let that person who's closest to it know that and mm-hmm. feel that, because they're already dealing with so much of it, you know?
Yeah. It's not their responsibility to take care of you.
Right.
It's not exactly. their responsibility to manage your expectations. They already have a ton going right. on. So, okay.
Yeah. yeah. And kind of also along those lines of, like, supporting them, you know, when people don't know what to say to people going through something.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to bring up, you know, the elephant in the room, or kind of make it uncomfortable for that person. Well, you know what? They're already dealing with it, so it's already uncomfortable for them. So
right.
just kind of acknowledging it and acknowledging that they're going through it, is it will help way more, I think, than not saying anything.
Yeah. Could it be just as simple as just sending, like, a text saying, like, hey, I just want you guys to know that I'm thinking of you, and I hope, you know, everything's going okay.
Yeah, like, that was so helpful and supportive, even just that.
Okay, good. I think that's really good for people to hear, just to know that even if you don't know what to say, because you don't want to bring it up, it's going on, it's happening, it's something
right.
that they're probably consumed with anyway, so it's, you bringing it up isn't going to make it worse.
Right.
If
make
anything,
it any worse. Yeah.
It's just mm-hmm. going to let them know that, you know, you're there to support them, and, you know, any support is probably very appreciated.
Exactly.
Well, Dana, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about how to deal with, you know, these illnesses and things like that. I know, especially for what you and David and Livvy went through, it's probably one of, like, the worst things that any parent would hear. So mm-hmm. I do want to thank you so much for kind of opening up and sharing your experience and your story about everything that you went through. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I was really nervous to come on here and talk about it, but I think it makes it easier to to process when you do talk about things. And hopefully if somebody, you know, needs some of this information, it'll be helpful for them as well.
Exactly. Yeah. I think just knowing that somebody else is kind of going through or has gone through and kind of came out the other side of everything, all the crap that they had to go through, is, I think, will really help people and will hopefully, you know, resonate with some people really well. So again, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, if you enjoy listening to this episode, please rate, comment, and subscribe. You can find The Impossible Job on B1015.com, keyword podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. You can like The Impossible Job on Facebook or follow me on Twitter @_impossiblejob. And if you would like to be a guest or have a idea for a show, please, you can email me at laura@wbqb.com. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed by the host and guests on this podcast are their own and not necessarily those of Centennial Broadcasting.